Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon, and as always, I am very pleased to be here talking about baseball cards, and you happen to be here too, listening to me talk about baseball cards as we continue our travels through the big old binder of vintage cards, and we are right in the middle of the wacky, wild me decade. Yes, the 1970s, and there is no set from the 1970s that represents the 1970s as much as our featured set this week. 1975 Tops. If you like color, whoo, you got plenty of color in this set. It is a set that is very tacky, not delightfully tacky like I proclaimed 72 Tops was, but very tacky, and it actually has quite a few flaws in the set, but the one thing that really helps this set keep going is the incredible rookie class. Most notably, George Brett, Robin Yount, rookie cards in this set, as well as several others we'll get to a little later on in the podcast. And of course, my biggest failure as a baseball card collector, it happened a long time ago, but I once passed up the opportunity to buy a rack pack of 75 Tops. A rack pack I could have had for probably just a few bucks, now that I think about it. So I'll rehash that story. I've shared it a few times. But we'll also focus on our random pull, card number 510, Vita Rochelle Blue. The gun-blazing lefty for the swinging A's of the early 1970s. And he was also the last of the swinging A's to play for that team late in the 70s. And it wasn't because team owner Charlie Finley didn't try to move Vita Blue like everybody else. It's just Commissioner Bowie Kuhn put up the roadblock every time that Blue was being moved by Charlie Finley, along with several other players. So we'll talk a little bit about Vita Rochelle Blue, or as Finley would want him to be known as, Vita True Blue. Vita was not a big fan of that. We'll look back at a Hall of Fame-worthy career. He's not in the Hall of Fame, though, but not necessarily for overall stats, even though those are pretty impressive, but Vita Blue had some of the best seasons that any pitcher had throughout the 1970s. I won't say he was the most consistently dominant pitcher of the 1970s, but it is very safe to argue that he is easily one of the top 10 pitchers of the 1970s. You could say top five, and I wouldn't argue with you that much. I wouldn't put him one or two, but he would definitely be perhaps four or five, depending on everybody else that you have on the list there. Now, before we talk about what's being discussed on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, and before we dive deep into Vita Blue's career and the 1975 top set, a little disclosure. I'm recording this show a little earlier than I normally do. You're listening to it. If you're one of the early risers, you're listening to it Tuesday morning, 10 o'clock Eastern, when we post all of our new episodes. Or even if you're listening to it on Wednesday, you know, you're still catching it early. But I am on vacation, just running away with the family for a few days. If you listen carefully, you will hear the rumble of thunder in the background as I'm recording this during a classic Florida afternoon thunderstorm. And it's a joy to listen to a thunderstorm, as long as it's not severe. And as long as you're not out in it, or worse yet, driving in it, because nobody knows how to drive here when it rains. This is recorded a few days in advance, and that has changed up a few things for this week. One, our auction break, which we've been doing recently a little more of, and we've gotten some more people involved with it. Postponing it this week, got a little busy earlier in the week. We're pushing it to next weekend. Again, the items up for bids will be three unopened packs of 82 Fleer. And even though 82 Fleer is one of my least favorite sets of all time, never mind just 1982, of all time, the one redeeming factor of that set is the Cal Ripken Jr. rookie card. So somebody will have a chance to pick up perhaps a Ripken rookie or a third-year Ricky Henderson card, or you've got a lot of great young stars, including Brett and Yount and Carlton Fisk and Dale Murphy and Paul Molitor. I mean, there's so many great players that came up in the mid to late 70s that are featured in 82 Fleer. It's going to be a heck of an item that will be up for bids. But we will do that next week. And also, we do have some 86 Fleer cello packs, and I will be on the prowl for a few more items to auction off. And as I said in last week's show, we're going to try to focus on mid to late 70s into early to mid 80s packs. That seems to be the wheelhouse for everybody. There's enough excitement about opening those items, but also it's affordable for most everybody. The oldest pack we've had is a 77 Topps pack. But again, if I can find good value for something from the mid to late 70s, I will get it and we will auction it off. And that's been part of the struggle lately. I've noticed that a lot of unopened packs from the late 70s and even going into 80, 81, the market's really high on them right now. So we'll see if we can find ourselves a bargain along the way. Now, I've also noticed over the last few weeks, we've had a pretty good spike in listenership. We've picked up a lot more listens, more listeners over the last, I'd say, 4 or 5 episodes. So let me reset here. Hi, my name is Matt Salmon. Pleasure to meet you. The host of Wax Ecstatic, our nostalgic look through some great and not so great baseball cards. It started about a year ago as I went through a monster box of cards. It started with 81 Fleer, and we did 81 Topps and 81 Donruss, and I went all the way up through what was left of my childhood collection, which would be the 1993 cards. And then through a listener poll, we decided the next step would be to go through the binder of the vintage cards, and that would be 54 through 80, with the exception of 55 and 56, because I don't have any from those years, at least not yet. But we've been doing that. So if you're just joining the show, thank you so much. Again, our new episodes come out Tuesday mornings at 10 o'clock Eastern Time. And on the weekends, we feature the flashback editions, where we go back through our archive and pick out a show that we'd like for you to give a second listen to. And this weekend's flashback episode, we wanted you to take a second look at 89 Bowman. And 89 Bowman, and in fact, Bowman in general, you know, the first couple, 2-3 years that Bowman made its comeback, 89, 90. Some people hate 91, but I really like 91 Bowman. But anyways, you know, especially 89 and 90, collectors just don't like those sets. They just crap all over them. And in my opinion, while 89 Bowman is certainly not the best card that Bowman has put out, or the best card of 1989, I mean, hello, Upper Deck. You know, that kind of takes the cake. But, you know, there were some other, you know, A-plus efforts in 89, especially, in my opinion, Topps and Donruss. I thought they put out some pretty good cards that year. Even though Bowman gets trashed, I think 89 Bowman falls in that same category as 88 Donruss. When you look at 88 Donruss, it is not as bad as people make it out to be. It's just 88 Donruss is the poster child of the junk wax era. Even though there are cards that looked worse, even though there are cards that are worth less, even though there are cards that were printed in larger quantities than 88 Donruss, everybody craps on 88 Donruss. Well, 89 Bowman is right there. And for most people, and we discussed this in the podcast, for most people it's because it was a new product that certainly didn't match up to Upper Deck. You know, Upper Deck raised the bar, and you had the, you know, color photos on the front and back and the high quality cardstock and the, you know, tamper proof wrapping and the, you know, the foil stamps on the back to, you know, try to steer away counterfeit artists. And you had, you know, a whole bunch of bells and whistles with Upper Deck. You know, Bowman was at the other end of the spectrum. And because so, a lot of people thought it was just a boring card. But I think the overriding problem with Bowman, and I do understand this, is that because Bowman went back to the old Bowman size for baseball cards, which is not 3.5 inches by 2.5 inches, but 3.5 by 2.75, you know, by the time 1989 had come around, baseball card collecting was not just a hobby, it was a business. It was the industry. And it had been for several years at this point in time. But, you know, we were collecting these cards and putting the valuable ones in the little nine pocket plastic pages, or you're putting them in the special top loader holders. And, you know, when Bowman came around, maybe you got a Ken Griffey Jr. or a Jose Canseco or some valuable card, but you couldn't store it anywhere. You had to buy special pages and buy special boxes, and it became a real headache. So a lot of people don't like it, but I encourage you to listen to that flashback episode. Just scroll through our Wax and Gum Stains timeline. You'll find it there. And give a listen to it. I think that Bowman, you know, I try to explain what they tried to do. I also give them credit for rethinking presentation of stats on the backs of the cards, and that is part of the Bowman cards that I've always enjoyed, especially those early releases in the late 80s and early 90s. And of course, we've got the background story of our random pull, which was Jose Canseco. And a lot of people, you know, they know of Jose Canseco as a circus sideshow. You know, he's just been this freak for the last 20, 25 years, and that's all they know. Very similar to Michael Jackson. You know, people who are younger than 30 or even 35 years old, you probably remember Michael Jackson as just this freak show. But, you know, for those of us who are a little older, we remember Michael Jackson owned the world. You know, he was called the King of Pop for a reason. It wasn't just a catchy little nickname. This guy was pop music, you know, in particular like 1983, but then, you know, plus or minus 5 or 6 years. And of course, his time with the Jackson 5 as well. So, you know, while much like Michael Jackson's life went from very promising to upside down and then into this freakish sideshow, same thing with Jose Canseco. And I've got the backstory about how his family escaped from Cuba and how he was a star player in Miami. And he was being compared to, or people thought of him as, the next Babe Ruth. You know, when he was in his prime in 89, 90, 91, people saw him as the next Babe Ruth. But then, of course, he got tied up in steroids, got tied up in the celebrity life, had a bad attitude about him. And again, really in the last 20, 25 years, it's all gone downhill. And he's, you know, really just a, you know, another reality show star in our world now. He's not this former great player. He's just this, you know, wart on baseball history's backside, basically. So make sure you check that out. We'll have another Flashback Friday episode, something from our archives, which we will feature this upcoming weekend. Now, speaking of archives, I told you about the new shows. You can listen to all of our shows on any of the following platforms. Our main platform is Audio Boom. That's the home base. But you can also listen to us on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, and TuneIn. Also, I want to let you know that if you appreciate what you hear on this program, while I am not trying to make money from the show, that was never the plan from the outset. I just wanted to talk about baseball cards, and we've had this phenomenal outcome, you know, this outpouring of support. People want to hear talk about baseball cards, and especially some of the vintage stuff. If you really appreciate it, if you got a couple of bucks, please make a donation to the Wax Ecstatic tip jar. And we actually have two tip jars now, the long-standing one via PayPal, and you can access that by visiting paypal.me/waxecstatic, and you can make a donation that way, or by popular demand. We had a few people ask about this when we unveiled the PayPal tip jar a few months ago. You can do it through Venmo. So we've opened up a Venmo account. If that's your preferred way of doing online transactions, you're more than welcome to do so. I think you have to be a friend of mine, though. So go ahead and put out a friend request and I'll accept it. But if you have a few bucks and would like to tip me for the work that we do here, I'd greatly appreciate it. Like I said, I'm not looking to make a ton of money. There are some production costs, you know, some low overhead to make this thing happen. And then there's the one thing that you can't really put a price on, and that is time. Believe it or not, a 45-minute or 50-minute show is not magically done in 45 or 50 minutes. I am a professional broadcaster. I do try to clean it up and make it sound good. So there is, you know, 2-3 hours that goes into every show to make it the way it is. So whether it's $2 or $20 or $200, God bless you if you're that guy, whatever you can afford, if you want to give us a tip, again, paypal.me/waxecstatic, or now on Venmo at venmo.com/waxecstatic. And for those of you who have already contributed, thank you very much. I greatly appreciate it. And for those of you considering contributing, please do. I greatly appreciate it in advance, and it will at least ensure that Wax Ecstatic continues to go strong for a very, very long time. Now, as for our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, another very active week there, and I encourage all of our listeners to share Wax and Gum Stains with your friends, collectors who collect now or haven't collected in a very long time. A lot of response to our previous podcast on 74 Tops. A lot of people love 74 Tops, and it's not only because of the appearance of the card, and it's also relatively easy to find nowadays. But it's the variation cards that aren't so easy to find, most notably the San Diego Padres / Washington National League cards that I discussed in the podcast. And again, the brief backstory is in the middle of the 1973 season, it seemed like a foregone conclusion that the San Diego Padres were going to fold up shop and move east to Washington, D.C. It would have been the district's third attempt in 14 years at keeping a Major League Baseball team in town. But as the deal slowly started unraveling and falling apart, Ray Kroc swoops in at the last minute in the spring of 1974, buys the team, keeps them in San Diego. But because 1974 was the first year that Topps released its set in one single series, for one, to save money on not overproducing high number cards in the fifth, sixth, seventh series, and to basically just move out all cards at once, but also because they had an exclusive marketing deal with JCPenney. That was the only way you could get the complete factory set back then, was to order it through the Penny catalog. Well, because of that arrangement, and because some cards had already been put to press, Topps had to stop the presses and reprint several cards of the San Diego Padres, which said Washington National League. Well, then they had to remove that and put San Diego Padres on the card. And I had made a generalization saying that Topps had to reprint all the cards of the Padres. And Robert J. Lawson, one of our listeners, tweeted at me a couple times, pointing out in great detail when I said that they had to reproduce all the cards, when in actuality, not all of the San Diego Padres cards were stamped Washington National League. So while he was looking at the grassy knoll and detecting if my head went back and to the left, and I'm just kidding around here, Robert, I did say, all right, let's straighten the record in this episode. I do like to get facts straight. I do like to get facts correct. I don't like being incorrect about things. And I'll say I was incorrect on that statement simply because I was making a generalization. I wanted to talk more about the 74 Topps set design and the career of Don Sutton, who was our random poll. And I wanted to try to tell the Padres Washington story as quickly but as detailed as possible. So I basically glossed over the fact that all of the Padres cards were Washington cards and they had to be switched. So that is inaccurate. In reality, there are just 15 cards, 13 player cards, the team card, and then the manager and coaching staff card that all had the Washington and National League banners that had to be changed out for San Diego. Now, one of the cards that was never a Washington National League card, and this is a fact that I should have included in the podcast, was Dave Winfield, because Dave Winfield's card was the big rookie card of the 74 top set. You know, you had Dave Parker and Bucky Dent and a couple other notable players, but Dave Winfield by far is the big rookie card, and a lot of collectors take note of the top rookie card from a set. So you'll never find a Washington National League Dave Winfield card because it was never made. And again, if you're being real particular, were all Padres cards labeled Washington National League cards? No. I wasn't trying to mislead anybody there. It's again, I was just generalizing the story here that Topps had to stop what they were doing and reprint the cards, and that the Washington National League variations are valued more than the San Diego variations because there's fewer of the Washington cards that are out there. But the point is still, Topps was already in production. Cards were already cut from their sheets. Some cards were already packaged in wax packs in their boxes, ready for shipping. and Topps made the smart business decision, instead of scrapping, you know, tens of thousands of dollars worth of product to make this correction, they just decided, well, the hell with it. It'll go out there. We'll fix what's still here, which was still, again, the vast majority of the set. You know, probably 85, 90% of what went out there, correctly said San Diego Padres on the cards. So, again, Robert, thanks for the note. I hope that cleared that up there. It certainly wasn't intentional, or it wasn't an uneducated guess. I was just trying to generalize the story there. But it is true, not all San Diego Padres cards said Washington National League. It was only 15, but still collectors love trying to track those cards down. And I've got a couple. I know I've got Cito Gaston and one or two others. I forget who the players are, but they're kind of neat. And in fact, I've got the San Diego version of Cito Gaston. So in the binder, they're placed next to each other. So you can see the two pieces of evidence of the one that got away a little too soon and the one that got collected. And a lot of fans were talking about those National League cards, including Shaw Law Offices, one of the biggest events of my childhood. My quest for a Washington card of Willie McCovey obsessed me. Don Fulton also chimes in, love it. My personal quest to add the Washington cards to my 1974 collection was Indiana Jones-esque. Well, I hope you didn't have the giant boulder chasing you down. That would have been a card you just kind of, you know, leave by the side. I can live without that one. Jim W. responding to the Don Sutton picture that we posted said, missing this one. Well, Jim, if I had a second, I'd let you know, but it doesn't look like I have that. But if I come along to an extra one, then who knows? Maybe we can connect and I can get it heading over your way. And also some very kind comments from Tony L., who is a new listener. Peter Steinberg also mentioning that he enjoys the podcast Cardboard Clubhouse as well. Dub Mentality, a lot of the longtime listeners welcoming in the newbies. So thank you again so much for listening to Wax Ecstatic and for following us on Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. All right, let's take a look at 1975 Topps. As I said before, if 72 Topps was delightfully tacky, 75 Topps was just plain tacky. And no better representative of how tacky it was than this Vita Blue card, as every Topps card that year not only had the Wowie Kazam 3D presentation of the team name at the top, but it also had a two-tone border. The top, I wouldn't say half, it's actually about top 60% of the card is one color. The bottom 40% of the card is another color. So here you have this Vita Blue card, and it actually makes me want to drink like an Arnold Palmer, because you've got pink and yellow together here on the outside of the card, on the outside border, mixing in rather oddly with Vita Blue's green Oakland Athletics uniform and his lucky cap. If I read correctly, once a long time ago, Vita Blue had a lucky baseball cap that he had worn since, I think, 1970. And he went a good 5 or 6 years wearing that same cap. So you've got that faded, dirty, musty old cap in this particular picture. But, you know, another example is the George Brett rookie card, where the top portion of the card is this dark green, the bottom portion is this dark purple, and Royals is in this kind of a pinkish purple with the black 3D effect on it. So it is a very tacky design, but it is so representative of the 1970s in general, but especially 1975. So again, a quick history lesson. We touched on this a little bit in 72 Topps, but in 1975, color was all the rage. Color television had finally moved to the head of the pack. More people were buying color TVs. It was more affordable. Black and white television, or at least black and white television sets, were on the way out. You know, color television had technically been around since the mid-50s, but didn't really gain some traction until the mid-60s. Well, by the mid-70s, everybody had it. So in order to enhance their team's appearance on television, you had Major League Baseball owners who were dressing up their teams in some pretty wild outfits. Of course, the most wild started in 1975. That, of course, the Houston Astros Tequila Sunrise, or Fruit Loops jersey, as some people will call it. You know, it wasn't just baseball. Color TV affected sports so much. And of course, at the same time, fashion trends were changing. You had the bell-bottom clothes, you had the platform shoes, you had the crazy designs. Watch that old sitcom, That 70s Show, if you want a pretty accurate depiction of the fashion of the times. That show pretty much nails it. Or watch, you know, any classic TV on MeTV or Antenna TV. You know, those are typically HD stations. You can watch old episodes of Johnny Carson and Carol Burnett and Barney Miller and, you know, shows set or actually done in the 1970s. And you can see the, you know, color and pizzazz was all the rage. You saw that in the sport of baseball, and you saw that in the design of 75 Tops. So even though I knock 75 Tops, and 75 Tops has never been one of my favorite sets, but even though I knock it because it is a rather corny look, it is very representative of the times. And again, something that Tops always would strive to do, and they still do to this day, but even going back 40 plus years ago, they wanted to make a design that represented the times. And while they dialed things down in 73 and 74, you know, it was a very conservative time too. Well, by 75, you have the color coming out. You've got the fashion designs changing. You know, disco music is moving to the front and center. You know, the wild and crazy part of the 70s is coming out at this time, as opposed to the kind of somber hangover from the 60s that the first 3 or 4 years of the decade is typically equated to. So even though I've never liked the design, a lot of collectors don't like the design. You can't say that 75 Tops is not 1975. It very, very, very much is. Now, the backs of the cards, this is one of the many flaws in the 75 top set, and it's very similar to the 72 top set. I don't like them because they're kind of hard to read. It's an interesting mix of colors here where you have a dark green, not the avocado green, but a dark green that you saw in the 74 tops, but it's blending with this light pink and dark pink. And what makes it really difficult to read is the gray cardstock at the time. Now, one thing that does help out the backs of the cards is the vertical presentation of all this information. It would be the last time until 1993 that Topps used a vertical presentation on the backs of their cards. But you also have a 1975 design here where you've got this big kind of semicircle. It's almost like a cul-de-sac shape with a little cartoon factoid or a trivia question. Next to that in the dark pink is the player's personal information. Beneath that cartoon, you've got the player's name and the card number, the complete stats there, and then, if room permitted, some other interesting tidbits at the bottom of the card. Now, you will notice with this Vita Blue card, by looking at the front or the back, it is miscut. In fact, it's not even just off-center. It's a little top-heavy, too. 1975 Topps was notorious for bad cut cards, not just off center, but diamond cut, and you know, way off center, and again, not just left and right, but top and bottom. So you will find a lot of 75 Topps cards. You can find them real cheap at a card store where the centering is not just like a 60-40 or a 70-30 issue. It's 90-10. You know, you can see the color, or in some cases, the team name of the, you know, card that was beneath it on the sheet at the bottom of a card. So Topps production values were not very strong in 1975 as they whipped out a lot of these cards. We didn't have a lot of quality control. You know, they didn't stop the presses to reset the plates and get everything back in line. So you will find quite a few off-center, miscut, diamond-cut cards of 75 Topps. But again, despite the problems with the miscutting of cards, despite the tacky design, also all the color on the borders meant that it was a difficult card set to keep in mint condition. Despite all of that, including the hard-to-read backs, 75 Topps is saved by the rookie cards of George Brett, also Robin Yount, and let's not forget Jim Rice, Gary Carter, Freddie Lynn and Keith Hernandez. So you add all those cards to the cards of the young stars of the early 70s and late 60s that were pretty prevalent by then, and you've got a blockbuster group of cards here in this set. It was a 660 card set. You had the 1974 season highlight leading off the set, and of course, because those were the first seven cards and they were typically manhandled by kids a little more than cards that were a little deeper in the set numbering, those cards are valued a little higher than your standard card. You also had your league leaders, your playoff and World Series highlights, plus MVP cards. So despite the tacky design, you've got a pretty popular collection of players here, and that is what has kept 75 Tops relevant and less ridiculed. If you don't like it, you're kind of my mindset where you go, well, it's not a really nice looking card, but you also appreciate A, the fact that it is very representative of the time, and B, it is just loaded with some key rookie cards, but also star cards of some of the late 60s and early 70s stars who would continue to dominate the sport throughout the 1970s and in many cases into the early 1980s. Now, I have to do a little sidebar here, a story that I have shared before, but again, we've got a lot of new listeners, so maybe you don't know this story. I have mentioned this in two or three shows before, and it all started actually with a question on our Twitter feed, Wax and Gum Stains. A long time ago, somebody asked, what is the worst trade that you've made for cards? And I am proud to say that I really couldn't think of any worst trade. If I traded cards, I was pretty smart about what I traded them for. But I will say that the one biggest regret I have in my years of collecting goes all the way back to 1990. I was 12 or 13 years old at the time. I had only been really collecting cards, I mean like voraciously collecting cards, for about a year at this time. So even though I was buying cards left and right, I was buying every brand I could get my hands on and already branching out into older sets, like in 1990, still going out and buying packs from 87, 88, 89, 86 too. I would occasionally go to flea markets, you know, again, pre-internet days, you had to get up off your couch and buy these cards. But I would go to flea markets or you'd find them in a bargain bin at some card shops. You know, I would collect cards from the 60s and 70s, and they were common cards in most cases, but I really enjoyed, you know, if I was plunking down $5, getting 10 or 15 cards back from the 60s and 70s. It was a neat history lesson, not only of the hobby, but of the sport itself. Well, sometime in 1990, and I don't necessarily remember when during the year, I was at a Toys R Us, and this is back in the day before there was a Toys R Us in every town. Even as a big of a city as Tampa is, back in 1990, I think there was only one Toys R Us in the city of Tampa. Now, like I said, there's probably 10 or 12. But we didn't get to go to shop there that often because we didn't live in the neighborhood that the store was in. And I have no idea why we were at this store. The only reason I can think of is there was a pretty big mall, still is, by the way, a university mall by the University of South Florida. There was a pretty big mall about half a mile or a mile down the road. And the only thing I can think of is my family was at the mall. We were shopping for something at the mall, and we somehow ended up at Toys R Us, and that's it. So I'm at Toys R Us. It's 1990. You're in the midst of the junk wax era baseball hobby craze. And I remember seeing a big vat of 90 Donruss packs by the checkout line. They had kind of this little baseball card corner. And you had all the new releases for 1990 there. But I remember a ton of Donruss cards. I believe they were rack packs. And I'm looking at this big vat of wax or rack packs, and I'm just kind of shuffling through them. And there was, I kid you not, a 75 Tops rack pack within this pile of Donruss cards. I don't know why it was there. I know, you know, you can see nowadays, you'll see, you know, quote unquote, vintage packs that are, you know, resold, and you've seen it. You don't see it as much now at Walmart and Target. You used to a few years ago, but you know, a few years ago, they would have a box of, you know, 87 Tops or 88 Fleer, you know, with all the other baseball cards. So you could buy, you know, some of these older boxes for 10 or 15 bucks along with the new stuff. So maybe it was purposely placed there by Tops or by a card wholesaler just to unload some old stuff. Maybe, you know, on a whim, somebody put it in there. I don't know. But all I know is right there, I could have had a rack pack of 1975 Tops for probably, I don't know, $2, whatever the Donruss cards were going for. Yet in my naivete, I'm looking at this going, oh, that's kind of odd. What's this old pack of cards doing in here? Well, I don't want that. Here's all the new cards. So yes, my biggest hobby regret is swimming through a vat of 1990 Donruss rack packs and kicking aside the 75 Tops rack pack. And ever since, this is now 27 years and going now, ever since I have kicked myself because who knows what would be in that pack. And I'll tell you, had I bought that, I would have opened it. You know, I had no idea of, you know, I mean, now you get a 75 Tops rack pack. If it's in great shape, you know, you're getting it graded. You're getting it, you know, hermetically sealed. You're trying to sell it for $3,000. But I would have opened it. I would have seen what was in there. And if I got a Brett or a Yount or, you know, a Gary Carter rookie card, that would have been great. But I would have been perfectly happy with however many cards came in there. Was it 42, I think, in the rack pack? I would have absolutely just ripped it right open and played around with those cards. But again, you know, I was a little naive. I was in my first year of collecting. I knew what was in there, but I didn't know what was in there. So you can ridicule me as much as you want. But if I ever come along a vat of rack packs and I see a 75 rack pack of Topps baseball cards, this time I will buy it and there will be no questions asked. Now, no question, Vida Blue probably deserved more votes for the Baseball Hall of Fame. He got barely the minimum when he was first eligible, and after a few ballots was taken off because he fell under 5% of the vote. But I really hope the Veterans Committee at some point in time takes a look at this guy, because in 17 years, and this is also including a year that he did not play because he was suspended, more on that in a moment, but in 17 years, Vida Blue picked up 209 wins. He had an earned run average of 3.27. Even though he was known as a wild pitcher, he ended his career essentially with a 2-to-1 strikeout to walk ratio, 2175 to 1185. And you look at, thanks to baseballreference.com, you look at the similar pitchers scorecard, you see Hall of Famer Catfish Hunter, Hal Newhouser, Don Drysdale, and other pitchers who are probably on the cusp of Hall of Fame status, Louis Tiant, Oral Hershiser, and, you know, the most similar by age, Steve Carlton, Clayton Kershaw, Fernando Valenzuela. You know, you've got some pretty good company here, but Vida Blue, because he had a couple of bad seasons, and because some of those bad seasons were not really his fault, that looms large over him, as well as his off-the-field issues. But when you look at this guy's career as a whole, I think you have to really take a second look at it and go, this is a guy who probably deserves better. My thanks to Rich Purazur of the Society for American Baseball Research, better known as SABR, S-A-B-R, did a great feature on Vida Blue And I was able to pull some very interesting things from here. I mean, I knew a lot about Vita Blue, but this was a well-researched article here. A native of Mansfield, Louisiana, that's in the northern part of the state, born in 1949, raised in the, to put it nicely, segregated South. In fact, Vita Blue Jr., one of six children, the oldest of six children, was a star in the making from a very early age, stood out as a baseball and football player. The problem was his high school, DeSoto High, didn't have a baseball team. And understandably why. It had a football team, but again, growing up in the segregated South, being a high school student in the mid-1960s, well, this was still a time when a lot of people thought only white folks should be playing baseball. So the black-only school that was DeSoto High School didn't have a baseball team. They had a football team. Vita Blue was the star Southpaw quarterback. But again, black quarterbacks in the mid-1960s, well, that just didn't happen, despite the fact that he was scouted by some relatively decent colleges, including Purdue, Notre Dame, and Houston. While he was outstanding as a football player, the staff at the school realized he could be a hell of a baseball player, too. And they say one man does not make a team. Well, I say you haven't seen Vita Blue, because Vita Blue was so talented, the school decided we need to make a baseball team so that we can showcase Vita Blue. So they built a team around Vita Blue, and that helped his cause as he was scouted by several baseball teams as well, including the Kansas City Athletics. A man by the name of Ray Swallow scouted him, wrote some very good notes, including the fact that Blue, in a seven-inning game, once struck out 21 players. He actually pitched a no-hitter in that game and lost, because he didn't have very good control back then. He walked 10 batters, but, well, that's something they could work on. So in 1967, Blue was drafted in the second round of the Major League Baseball Players Amateur Draft by the Athletics. And Blue decided to go the baseball route, not only because the long and winding road for a black quarterback to make it in college and pro football was pretty much non-existent at that point in time, and really wouldn't until Doug Williams came around 10 years later. Also because of the passing of his father at the time he was a senior in high school, he figured because he was the oldest child, he was now the man of the house. He needed to provide for his mother and five siblings. And by signing with the baseball team, he could at least get a pro contract and a bonus up front, which he did. 2-year contract worth $12,500 per year. That is probably twice what most residents of Mansfield, Louisiana made in 1967. So he works his way up through the A's farm system. And going into 1969, he is at Birmingham, which is the A's AA team at the time, playing at the legendary Rickwood Field, along with some legendary teammates at the time. He was just sailing along that season, much as he had in 1967 and 68 in the lower levels. Well, at this time, Charlie Finley, owner of the now Oakland Athletics, is getting a little antsy, a little impatient. He's got a lot of stud players in the minor leagues, but not a really good team playing in Oakland at the time. He's got a brand new 50,000-seat Coliseum that he's got to sell out, and it's not really working. You know, the wow factor of the A's has worn off ever since they moved to Oakland in 1968. So midway through the 1969 season, Blue is promoted directly from AA to Oakland and makes his major league debut on the day that man landed on the moon. So there was something in the air that night. He makes his major league debut July 20th, 1969 against the California Angels, loses that game, but would get a win on July the 29th over the Yankees and would wrap up his season in the bullpen, to which then A's coach Joe DiMaggio said, and I quote, "It was a shame to bring up a kid like that when he hasn't pitched two pro years. He throws as hard as anybody, but he hasn't learned to pitch yet," end quote. Now, Jolton Joe could cut to the bone with his commentary, but it was brutally honest, too, and the A's took note as Blue started in AAA at Iowa the next season, and he eventually became a September call-up, had a pretty good end to the 1970 season, and that was that. Now, while he was in Iowa, he took some diligent notes from former heat-throwing pitcher Juan Pizarro, learned more about control, learned more about pitch selection and placement of pitches, and because he was able to do that, he comes into the 1971 season as a bit of a dark horse. Granted, he had a 3-1 career major league record at that time, but after losing his first start to the Washington Senators, he would win 10 in a row and just take over the baseball world by storm, and especially the pitcher's mound. The 1971 season was an incredible season, and one season that certainly deserves consideration for his eventual Hall of Fame status, as Vida Blue would not only start in the All-Star game that year in Detroit, but he would also finish the year with a 24-8 record, a league-leading earned run average of 1.82. In 39 games started, he completed 24 of them, blanking the opponent 8 times. And for the kid who once had these crazy control problems, he threw 301 strikeouts to 88 walks. Not surprisingly, Vida Blue, your 1971 American League Cy Young Award winner and American League MVP. So coming off that great season, which the A's, you know, made the playoffs for the first time in 40 years, they would lose in the division playoffs to, or the ALCS, I should say, to Baltimore. But in a year like this, where Blue finally had it coming together, naturally he wanted a raise. So he hired a lawyer who was acting as an agent. Remember, this is the early days of the Players Association. There was no free agency at the time. Baseball still had the reserve clause, which meant the moment you signed a contract with a team, you were theirs for pretty much forever, until they decided to trade you, cut you, or send you to the minors without your permission. Well, Vida Blue decided to hold out. He wanted $115,000 after the Cy Young Award and MVP award-winning season. Well, asking for $115,000 from Charlie Finley, you might as well have been asking for $115 million. Charlie Finley threw nickels around like they were manhole covers. He didn't like it, so you had the holdout going on. And Blue would miss not only spring training in 1972, but also the first month of the season. Finally, Commissioner Bowie Kuhn pulling both sides together. Of course, this is the days before arbitration. And Blue brought his number down to 85. Finley publicly said, "I'm not going to give him more than 50. And they settled at 63. But you had a very acrimonious relationship building from there, because basically the wording of the deal was up for interpretation. Finley, of course, saying that he never wanted to pay Blue more than a $50,000 salary, spun it as, okay, there's $50,000 salary, there's a $5,000 bonus, here's an $8,000 college fund fee. And Blue would say, well, no, it is a $63,000 deal. So you start fighting over the minutiae. And when you're fighting with Charlie Finley over stuff like this, things don't go well. And the 72 season was a struggle for Blue, as he went 6-10, still had a 2.80 earned run average, and he was part of the A's World Championship, the first of three straight, and he would be more of a notable part of the next two World Series, going 20-9 in 1973. Although coming in as a distant seventh in the Cy Young Award voting, and then going 17-15 in 1974. The A's would keep winning division titles, though, in 1975, in part to Blue's performance, as he went 22-11 that year, another All-Star year for him, and another Cy Young Award candidacy year, although he would finish sixth in the voting. But by 1976, Charlie Finley starts dismantling the team for a number of reasons. One, even though Finley got his wish to move the A's to Oakland, in fact, when he bought the A's in Kansas City in 1962, I believe it was, he pretty much had one foot out the door. He never wanted to stay in Kansas City. Well, he's in Oakland. He's in this brand new stadium, and he's got a team that's won 3 World Series in a row and has appeared in the American League Championship Series for 5 consecutive seasons. But as he and many other professional sports owners have found out, when you are in Oakland, you are always in the shadow of San Francisco. And there is always more of a romantic connection for people with San Francisco than the gritty, hard hat, lunch pail Oakland. Or some people say, you know, more of the gangster setting of Oakland than what San Francisco is. And baseball wasn't cutting it there. Even though the Giants were poorly managed and not doing well on the team at the time, the A's could not compete with the Giants in the market. And by 1976, the A's and Giants almost left the market. Finley lived in Chicago, and he wanted to move the A's to the Chicago, as there were rumors that the White Sox were going to vacate for possibly Seattle. That's before Bill Veeck came in the winter of 75 and purchased the team. And there were also rumors that the Giants, in fact, really weren't rumors. There was a deal in place for them to be sold and moved to Toronto. And that's part of the reason why Toronto and Seattle got expansion teams in 1977, because there was litigation going on for those failed moves. And that's why they have baseball teams there. And also baseball didn't want to vacate the Bay Area 20 years after baseball or Major League Baseball had found its way there. So in 1976, struggling with finances and living in the shadow of the city of San Francisco, never mind the Giants, Finley starts dealing various players to different teams. Catfish Hunter was actually dealt before 76. In fact, before the 1975 season, he goes to the Yankees. Then, of course, you have the Reggie Jackson trade along with Kenny Holtzman to Baltimore before the 76 season. And in the middle of the 76 season, Finley was going to trade, or not really trade, but actually sell several more of his key players. Joe Rudy and Raleigh Fingers were briefly, for about 2 days, members of the Boston Red Sox. They had been sold for $2 million. And Blue had been sold to the Yankees for $1.5 million. Well, Bowie Kuhn sees what's going on here. This isn't just a competition or a competitive disadvantage situation here for Charlie Finley and the A's. Charlie's just cashing out before he can dump the team on somebody. And, you know, whether the team plays in Oakland or elsewhere, well, that's their problem. So Kuhn steps in and puts the kibosh on the Rudy, Fingers, and Blue deals. And while all this drama off the field is going on, Vida Blue is suffering on the field as well. Even though he posted an 18-13 season with a 2.35 earned run average, well, all of a sudden, you know, he's one of the few remaining pieces of this A's dynasty, and he's expected to deliver. Unfortunately, he signed a contract with the team prior to the 1976 season. Joe Rudy and Raleigh Fingers become free agents in 1977, so they go sign with other teams. And Vida Blue is stuck in Oakland. Now, he's making a lot of money, but he's just stuck in a bad situation. He's stuck with an owner that he hates. He's stuck with a team that is progressively terrible around him, and he can't really go anywhere. So he has one of his worst seasons where he goes 14-19. He, in fact, led the American League in losses that year. But again, through no fault of his own, you know, 3.83 earned run average, nothing crazy to write home about. But you look at the typical numbers for Vida Blue in terms of strikeouts and walks. You know, he was still putting up, you know, strikeout numbers around 160, about 80 walks. You know, he was still his normal self, but He just didn't have a good enough team around him. And finally, he is able to get free from Oakland in a trade to San Francisco as the A's pick up seven players, nobody really of you know, value, and $300,000 cash. So there you go. Along with Mario Guerrero, and Blue goes to San Francisco, and he starts to shine once again as the Giants are starting to become a better team. Goes 18-10 in 1978, starts the 78 All-Star game in San Diego. Had a little bit of an off year in 79, goes 14-14, had a 5.01 earned run average, but gets it all back together in 1980 and 81, has some decent All-Star seasons in San Francisco. Now comes a shocking trade. At the end of spring training in 1982, he and Bob Tufts get sent to Kansas City for Craig Chamberlain, Atlee Hamaker, Rennie Martin, and Brad Wellman. Hamaker is pretty much the only guy that really, you know, stayed in San Francisco for a long time there. And he goes to Kansas City, has a pretty productive 82 season. You know, he's 32 years old. He's lost a little zip on his fastball, but he's 13-12, 3.78 earned run average. The Royals are, you know, after a pretty dominant stretch in the late 70s, they're starting to, you know, rebuild and regather and make a charge for, you know, the American League West title in the mid 1980s. And I remember a legendary set of 1984 Fleer cards. Remember, Fleer would have a little fun. They would take two of their higher number cards and put them back to back, like we saw in the 83 Fleer cello break a couple weeks ago. You had the Ricky Henderson and Reggie Jackson. It was speed and power, and you put the cards next to each other, and they formed one big card. Well, there was one where Bud Black was a member of the Kansas City Royals, and Fleer had a picture of Bud Black sitting next to Vida Blue in the dugout. So you put the cards together, and you had Black and Blue. Well, there was plenty of bruising going on for Vida Blue at this time, not only on the field, as he has an absolutely miserable 83 season with the Royals, goes 0-5 with a 6.01 earned run average, and actually gets cut by the team in the middle of the season. Well, he also gets in trouble off the field during that season, as he and teammates Willie Wilson, Willie Akins, and Jerry Martin were arrested for buying cocaine, and Blue would plead guilty to cocaine possession. He served 81 days in prison, and as if that wasn't bad enough, Bowie Kuhn suspends him for the entire 1984 season. So out of a job and out on his butt, he skips the entire 1984 season, re-signs with the Giants in 1985, and sticks around for a couple of seasons, has a fairly respectful two seasons. Combined, he goes 18-18, and he had an earned run average of 3.87. He would briefly be a member of the Oakland Athletics in 1987, but he left the team during spring training, and that would be his final performance in Major League Baseball. Now, afterwards, Blue admitted to having a lot of substance abuse problems, notably cocaine, but also other drugs, marijuana, alcohol. He, in fact, dealt with a DUI incident, I think 12 or 13 years ago. And it's something that he has battled all his life, especially as he alluded to in the early 70s. That shouldn't be a surprise. It's well known that one of his teammates, another pitcher, Blue Moon Odom, dealt with substance abuse. It was something that had been around really since the 1960s in Major League Baseball, but became more and more prevalent. And Blue actually was part of the testimony. He testified in the Pittsburgh Pirates cocaine cases in the mid-1980s. So this is a guy who was, you know, unfortunately wrapped up in the scene, and nobody's really sure if he completely disavowed himself from that. What we can be sure of, though, is that he is still very active in baseball. He was a member of the senior professional baseball circuit in 1989 and 1990. He's dabbled in broadcasting as a television analyst for the Giants, and he is also a public speaker who talks about substance abuse and addiction to drugs and alcohol. So I'm hoping that if he hasn't already gotten his life's issues in order, I'm hoping that he does soon, because I'm also hoping that Vida Rochelle Blue, whom Charlie Finley once offered a couple grand to change his nickname to True, so that everybody on the team would call him Vita True Blue, and Vita didn't like that idea. It's another reason why Finley hated him. Vita Rochelle Blue, I think, deserves a second look for the Hall of Fame, because I know he doesn't have the 300 wins. He doesn't have the 3,000 strikeouts. He was part of a couple of no-hitters, and he was a pretty dominant left-handed pitcher in his day, known for his speed. This guy was a flamethrower. A lot of lefties are known more for a crafty assortment of pitches, not Blue. He would pound it down the middle, and chances are you weren't able to hit it. But you have three 20-win seasons. You have three World Series championships. You have five division championships, even though historically he didn't always pitch very well in the playoffs. And you also have six All-Star appearances. Something tells me he probably should have gotten a lot more in the Hall of Fame vote than he should have. But I really think if you look at the big picture here on what he did, and again, especially with how pitchers are being used today, you're not going to have pitchers that have 24 complete games. You're not going to have pitchers that have eight shutouts in the season. And I think 20-win starters are going to be a rarity. So, you know, the role has changed a lot, but I think in the role that the starting pitcher was back in the 70s and the early 80s when he was starring, I think Vita Blue was, as I mentioned at the start of this podcast, you can argue if he wasn't in the top 10, definitely you could consider him in the top five of pitchers, not just in the American League, but with his later time in San Francisco in the 1970s. So that is our random pull card number 510, the pink lemonade card design. Pink on the top, yellow on the bottom, big blue 3D A's at the top, and then Vita Blue's name, position, and the faux autograph at the bottom as we look skyward at the big, crafty, left-handed pitcher from Louisiana, a pitcher who was so good, the high school created a baseball team around him. Quite the story, quite the career, and I certainly hope that he gets a second look by a veterans committee and by collectors too. You know, you can find Vita Blue cards rather inexpensive, because he didn't, even though he was in that same category as Steve Carlton and Nolan Ryan at the time, I think he doesn't quite get the honor that he deserves, and be it because he had some off seasons or he had some off field problems. I think we need to kick that by the wayside and really look what Vita Blue did for the game and also for the Players Association. Like I mentioned, you know, he had that tremendous 1971 season, and he missed a month of the 72 season in a holdout, which he essentially won by forcing Charlie Finley's hand to pay him more than $50,000. So that's our random pull. That's the random and wacky 1975 top set, despite its goofy design, still loved by collectors because of those George Brett and Robin Yount rookie cards, not to mention some of the other big-name cards that are in there as well, including Keith Hernandez, Gary Carter, and others. All cards I could have had, had I not looked at all the 1990 Donruss cards around him on that fateful day in 1990 at the Toys R Us on Fowler Avenue in Tampa. Your thoughts about the set, about the player, about anything in the hobby, feel free to comment at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. Also, don't forget, you can send us a tip, thank us for the hard work we do with this podcast, either via PayPal at paypal.me/waxecstatic or now through Venmo at venmo.com/waxecstatic. We've got another Flashback Friday edition coming up this upcoming weekend, and then we look at a colorful but toned down, still a pretty sharp 76 top set. We'll do a random pull from that binder as well in our next podcast, the next new one, next Tuesday at 10 a.m. Eastern via Audio Boom, iTunes, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, and Stitcher. Those are the places you can also catch all of our archived episodes. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. You've been listening to Wax Ecstatic. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll see you next time.